From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Beckoning Monk. Many years ago, about the time of the Tabridge Gale, I was staying at Edinburgh with a friend of mine, an actor manager. I had just come down from the paint room of the theater and was emerging from the stage door when I encountered Miss Elsie H., a then well-known actress. "You are just the very person I wanted to meet," she said. "Allow me to introduce you to my friend, Mr. Spencer Ashton. He's not an actor, he's an artist, and he's got such a queer, queer story about ghosts and things near your beloved St. Andrews." I bowed to Mr. Ashton, who was a quiet-looking man, pale and thin, rather like a benevolent animated hairpin. He reminded me somehow of Fred Vokes. We shook hands warmly. "Yes," he said, "my story sounds like fiction, but it is a fact, as I can prove. It is rather long, but it may possibly interest you. Where could we foregather?" "Come and dine with me at the Edinburgh Hotel tonight at 8. I'll get a private room," I said. "Righto," said he, and we parted. That evening at 8 o'clock we met at the old Edinburgh Hotel, now no longer in existence, and after dinner he told me his very remarkable tale. "Some years ago," he said, "I was staying in a small coast town in Fife, not far from St. Andrews. I was painting some quaint houses and things of the sort that tickled my fancy at the time, and I was very much amused and excited by some of the bogey tales told me by the fisher folk. One story interested me." "And what was that?" I asked. "Well, it was about a strange, dwarfish old man who they swore was constantly wandering about among the rocks at nightfall. A queer, uncanny creature, they said, who was eye beckoning to them and who was never seen or known in the daylight. I heard so much at various times and from various people about this old man that I resolved to look for him and see what his game really was. I went down to the beach times without number, but saw nothing worse than myself, and I was almost giving the job up as hopeless when one night I struck oils, as the Yankees would say." "Good," I said, "let me hear." "It was after dusk," he proceeded, "very rough and windy, but with a feeble moon peeping out at times between the racing clouds. I was alone on the beach. Next moment, I was not alone." "Not alone," I remarked. "Who was there?" "Certainly not alone," said Ashton. "About 3 yards from me stood a quaint, short, shriveled old creature. At that time, the comic opera of Pinafore was new to the stage-loving world, and this strange being resembled the character of Dick Deadeye in that piece. But this old man was much uglier and more repulsive. He wore a tattered monk's robe, had a fringe of black hair, heavy black eyebrows, very protruding teeth, and a pale, pointed, unshaven chin. Moreover, he possessed only one eye, which was large and telescopic-looking." "What a horrid brute," I said. "Oh, he wasn't half so bad after all," said Ashton, "though his appearance was certainly against him. He kept beckoning to me with a pale, withered hand, continually muttering, 'Come.' I felt compelled to follow him, and follow him I did." I lit up another pipe and listened intently. "He took me," resumed Ashton, "into a natural cave, a cleft in the rocks. And we went stumbling over the rocks and stones and splashing into pools. At least, I did. He seemed to get along all right. At the far end of this clammy cave, a very narrow staircase cut out of solid rock ascended abruptly about 20 or 30 steps, then turned a corner and descended again into a large passage. Then a mighty queer thing happened. "What might that be?" I inquired. "Well," my guide somehow or other suddenly became possessed of a huge great candlestick with a lighted candle in it, about 3 feet high, which lit up the vaulted passage. "We now stand in the monk's subway," he said. "Indeed. And who may you be? Are you a man or a ghost?" The queer figure turned. "I am human," he said. "Do not fear me. I was a monk years ago. Now I am reincarnate. Time and space are nothing whatever to me. I only arrived a short while ago from Naples to meet you here." "Good heavens, Ashton," I said. "Is this all true?" "Absolutely true, my dear fellow," said Ashton. "I was in my sound senses, not hypnotized or anything of that sort, I assure you. On and on we went, the little man with his big candle leading the way and I following. Two or three times the subway narrowed, and we had a tight squeeze to get through, I can tell you." "What a rum place," I interjected. "Yes, it was that," said Ashton. "But it got still rummer as we went up and down more stairs and then popped through a hole into a lower gallery. And I noticed side passages branching off in several different directions." "Walk carefully and look where you tread," said my monkish guide. "There are pitfalls here. Be very wary." Then I noticed at my feet a deep, rock-hewn pit, about 2 feet wide, right across the passage. "What is that for?" I asked. "To trap intruders and enemies," said the little monk. "Look down." I did so. And I saw at the bottom in a pool of water a whitened skull and a number of bones. We passed 4 or 5 such shafts in our progress. "Upon my word, this beats me altogether," I interpolated. "It would have beaten me altogether if I had fallen into one of those traps," said Ashton. Suddenly, the close, damp, fungus sort of air changed, and I smelled a sweet, fragrant odor. "I smell incense," I said to the monk. "It is the wraith, or ghost, of a smell," he said. "There has been no incense hereaway since 1546. There are ghosts of sounds and smells, just as there are ghosts of people. We are here surrounded by spirits, but they are transparent, and you cannot see them unless they are materialized, but you can feel them." "Hush, hark," said the monk, and then I heard a muffled sound of most beautiful chiming bells, the like I never heard before. "What is that?" "The old bells of St. Andrew's Cathedral. That is the ghost of sounds long ago." "Ceased," and the monk muttered some Latin. Then all of a sudden I heard very beautiful chanting. For a moment or more, then it died away. "That is the long-dead choir of monks chanting vespers," remarked my guide sadly. At this period, the monk and I entered a large, rock-hewn chamber, wide and lofty. In it, there were numerous huge old iron clamp chests of different sizes and shapes. "These," said the monk, "are packed full of treasures, jewels, and vestments. They will be needed again some day. Above us now, there are plowed fields, but long ago, right over our heads, there existed a church and a monastery to which these things belonged." He pointed with a skinny claw of a hand to one corner of the chamber. "There," he said, "is the staircase that once led to the church above." Ashton stopped and lit a cigar, then resumed. "Well, on we went again, turning, twisting, going up steps, round corners, through more holes, and stepping over pitfall shafts. It was a loathsome and gruesome place. Out of a side passage, I saw a female figure glide quickly along. She was dressed as a bride for a wedding. Then she disappeared. "Fear not," said the monk. "That is Mirren of Hepburn's Tower, the White Lady. She can materialize herself and reappear when she chooses, but she is not reincarnate as I am." Well, after we had gone on, it seemed for hours, as I have described, the monk paused. "I fear I must leave you," he said suddenly. "I am wanted. Before I go, take this," and he placed in my hand a tiny gold cup. delicately chased. It is a talisman, and it will bring you good luck always, he said. Keep it safe. I may never see you again here, but do not forget. Then I was alone in black darkness. He and his candle had vanished in a second. Quite alone in that awful prison, heaven only knows how far below the ground, I could never have gone back, and I feared to go forward. I was entombed in a worse place than the Roman catacombs, with no hope of rescue, as it was unknown and forgotten by all. What a fearful position to be in, I said. I should think it was, said Ashton. The awful horror of it I can never forget as long as I live. I was absolutely powerless and helpless. I had lost my nerve, and I screamed aloud in an agony of mind. I had some matches, and these I used at rare intervals, crawling carefully and feeling my way along the slimy floor of the passage. I had a terrible feeling, too, that something intangible but horrible was crawling along after me and stopping when I stopped. I heard it breathing. I struck a match, and it was lucky, for I just missed another of those pitfalls. By the light of the match, I saw a small shrine in an alcove which had once been handsomely ornamented. My progress forward was suddenly stopped by a gruesome procession of skeleton monks all in white. They crossed the main subway from one side passage and entered another. Their heads were all grinning skulls, and in their long bony fingers they bore enormous candles, which illuminated the passage with a feeble blue glare. "It's awful," I remarked. On and on I slowly went. It seemed hours and hours. I was exhausted and hungry and thirsty. After a time, I passed through open oak nail-studded doors that were rotting on their hinges, and then I saw a sight so horrible that I would never mention it to anyone. I dare not. I may know its meaning someday. I hope so. What on earth was it? I inquired eagerly. For heaven's sake, let me go on, and do not ask about it, said Ashton, turning ghastly pale. The horror of the whole thing so upset me that my foot slipped and I fell down what seemed to be a steep stairway. As I struck the bottom, I felt my left wrist snap, and I fainted. When I regained my senses for a brief moment, I found that the white lady, bearing a taper, was bending kindly over me. She had a lovely face, but as pale as white marble. She laid an icy cold hand on my hot brow, and then all was darkness again. Now listen, next time I came to myself and opened my eyes, I was out of the accursed passage. I saw the sky and the stars, and I felt a fresh breeze blowing. Oh, joy! I was back on the earth again, that I knew. I staggered feebly to my feet. And where on earth do you think I found I had been lying? I cannot guess, I said. Just inside the archway of the old Penn's gateway at St. Andrew's, said Ashton. How on earth did you get there? Heaven knows, said Ashton. I expect the white lady helped me somehow. It all seemed like a fearful nightmare. But I had the gold cup in my pocket and my broken wrist to bear testimony to what I had gone through. To make a long story short, I went home to my people, where I lay for 6 long weeks suffering from brain fever and shock. I always carry the cup with me. I am not superstitious, but it brings me good luck always. Ashton showed me the monk's gold cup. It was a beautiful little relic. Did you ever examine the place where you entered the passage? I asked. Oh, yes, he replied. I went there some years afterwards and found the cave, but it has all fallen in now. By Jove, it's very late. Thanks for the dinner. I must be off. Good night. I lit a pipe and pondered over that curious story. The entrance to the passage in the cave had fallen in. The exit from it in St. Andrews is unknown to Ashton. Only the white lady knows. On the whole, the story is wrapped in mystery, and does not help one much to unravel the wonders that lie in underground St. Andrews. We may know some day, or never. The Hauntings and Mysteries of Lawsdree Castle. It is many years ago since I was on a walking tour in the Highlands, far to the north of Bonnie Glenshee, and when on the moorlands I was overtaken for my sins by a regular American snowstorm, a genuine blizzard of the most pronounced type. I struggled along as well as I could for some considerable time, and then I became aware that someone was beside me. It was a young Highland lassie with a plaid over her head. I was pleased to learn from her that her name was Jean, that she was the niece of a neighboring innkeeper, and that she could speedily convey me to his haven of rest. We trudged along in the blinding snow without a word, and I was more than thankful to the lassie when I at last found myself out of the snow in a nice little sanded parlor with a glorious fire of peat and logs blazing on the hospitable hearth. A glass of something hot brought by mine host was most welcome. I found there was one other storm-stayed traveler in the wee house, an old family butler whose name I discovered was Jeremiah Anklebone. He had been on a visit to relations north and had been caught in the snow like myself. We were both thankful to find such a warm, cozy shanty on such an evening, and to use a Scots term, we foregathered at the ingle inside. He asked me if I knew much about spirits, to which I replied that I had just had a glass, but he at once explained that although not adverse to toddy, he alluded to spirits of another nature, for example, ghosts, banshees, bogards, and the like. I told him I had frequently been in so-called haunted places in various countries, but had never seen or heard anything except owls, bats, rats, or mice. He ventured the remark I had often heard before, that I could not be receptive, and that I told him I was thankful that I was not. He was a fine old fellow, an ideal family butler, and doubtless the recipient of many family secrets. He had big mutton chop whiskers and a bald head, and looked as if he had served turtle soup all his life. But it was not soup he was soaked with. He seemed fairly saturated with spook lore. He informed me quite calmly that he was gifted with a remarkable faculty of seeing apparitions, demons, etc. I could not help remarking that it seemed a very unpleasant faculty to possess, but he quite differed with me and got as warm as his toddy on the subject. I shall not in a hurry forget that wild evening in the Highland Inn before the blazing fire, or the wonderful narrations I heard from Butler Anklebone. Space precludes me from putting down here all the marvels he revealed to me. It seemed all his life, he was 62, he had been gasping like a fish on a river's bank to get into a really well-haunted house, but had utterly failed till he took the post of head butler at Lawsdree Castle, which he informed me was but a short distance from St. Andrews. He gave me a most tremendous description of the old castle, and from his account it seemed to be the asylum and gathering place of all the bogies in Britain and elsewhere. Congregated together there were the Ice Maid, the Brown Lady, a Headless Man, a Cold Lad, a Black Maiden, the Flaming Ghost, the Wandering Monk, a ghost called Silky, Old Martha, a Radiant Bay, an Iron Knight, a Creeping Ghost, Jumping Jock, Old No Legs, Great Eyes, a Talking Dog, the Corby Craw, a Floating Head, a Dead Hand, Bleeding Footprints, and many other curious creatures far too numerous to mention. The castle, he said, was full of uncouth and most peculiar sights and sounds, including rappings, hammerings, shrieks, groans, crashings, wailings, and the like. What a remarkable place, I said to Mr. Butler Anklebone. And how do you account for so many specters and so limited an area? Oh, there is no time or space for them, he said. They are earthbound spirits, and they can go from one part of the globe to another in a second. But they have their favorite haunts and meeting places, just as we folks have, and Lawsdree seems to appeal to their varied tastes. He then went on to tell me some details of the haunted castle. There are supposed to be, he said, beneath the castle, splendid old apartments, dungeons, winding passages, and cellars. But history states that any of those persons who tried to investigate these mysteries returned no more, so the entrances were walled up and are now completely lost sight of. There is a built-up chamber, but no one durst open it, the penalty being total blindness or death, and such cases are on record. There's also a coffin room shaped exactly like its name. But one of the queerest places at Lasdri is a small apartment with a weird light of its own. At night, this room can be seen from the old garden, showing a pale, uncanny, phosphorescent glow. Mr. Snaggers, that's the footman, and I unlocked the door and examined the place carefully. There's a table, a sofa, and a few old chairs therein, and an all-pervading sickly light equally diffused. The furniture throws no shadows whatever. The room seemed very chilly, and there was a feeling as if all one's vitality was being sucked out of one's body, and drawing one's breath caused pain. Snaggers felt the same. No one could live long in that eerie apartment. I know, we were glad to lock it up again. Then there's a spiral stair called Meg's Leg. I don't know the legend, but almost every night one hears her leg stumping up these steps. What a creepy place it must be, to be sure, I murmured gravely. Yes, said Anklebone, and I tell you, sir, Snaggers and I generally arranged to go up to bed together. One always felt there was something coming up the stairs behind one. When a person stopped, it stopped also, and one could hear it breathing and panting, but nothing was to be seen. Snaggers said one night, when the candle went out, he saw monstrous red eyes. But I saw nothing then. The creeping creature I only saw twice. It was like an enormous toad on spider's legs. They say it has a human head and face, but I only saw its back. Some folks say it is alive and not a ghost, and that it hides somewhere in the cellars, but we never could get a trace of it. One night, I was going down to the service room when my way was barred by a ghastly tall figure with great holes where eyes should have been, so I just shut my eyes and rushed through it downstairs. When I got down, I found all my clothes were covered with a vile, sickly-smelling, sticky sort of oil, and I had to destroy them all. Go on, please, I said. You astonish me vastly. Yes, he said slowly, it's all very queer. Lasdri is haunted, and no mistake. Naggers and I shared the same room. One night, a great blood-stained hand and arm came round the corner of the bed curtain and tried to grab me. It was dead ice-cold, too. Then a thing, an invisible thing, used to patter into the room, puffing and groaning, and get under the bed and heave it up. But we looked, and there was never anything there. And the door locked, too. We saw a great black corkscrew thing one night fall from the ceiling onto the floor and disappear. And then there was a mighty rush along the passage. Outside the door, a great crash, a yell, and a groan dying away far below. There was a humorous spirit also then, the Iron Knight. We called him Uncle. He was up to tricks. We didn't mind him. When the fat cook was sitting down to a meal, he'd pull back her chair, and down she would come with a rare crash. If any of the maids upset a tray of tea things, or fell downstairs with a kettle, or knocked over the great urn, they used to say, "Oh, that's Uncle again." I told him, Mr. Anklebone, that I was delighted there was a touch of comedy in such a gruesome place, as I preferred comedians to ghosts any day. One thing I learnt from his story, and that was that if he was head butler at Lasdri Castle, the head ghost was Sir Guy Ravelstock, whose portrait still hung in the old picture gallery. The castle dated back to Norman times, but about 1457 it fell into the hands of this Sir Guy Ravelstock, who had been educated at the Stadium General or University of St. Andrews. He and his two friends, Geoffrey de Beaumanoir and Roger Le Courville, held high revel and carnival in the old halls of Lasdri, and were the terror of the whole countryside. Sir Guy was a dissolute fellow, a gambler, and everything else bad. The neighbors alleged that he had sold himself to Old Nick. He would spill blood as if it was water, and he and his white steed, Nogo, were well known all over Fife and the Lothians. He was held to be a freebooter, a wizard, and a warlock, a highwayman, a pirate, and a general desperado. He had slain many men in mortal combat, and was found invulnerable. He must have been a sort of Michael Scott of Balwiri, I remarked. He must have been a holy terror, said the butler. I've seen him often, exactly like his portrait in the picture gallery. I've seen him in his old world dress with his sword hanging at his side, sometimes on his white horse, and sometimes on foot. There were always terrible knocking, shrieks, and crashes before he appeared, and all our dogs showed the greatest terror. I slept in an old four-poster bed, and he used to draw aside the curtain and glare at me constantly. He nearly always was accompanied by a specter of a negro carrying his head under his arm. Sir Guy was a great traveler in foreign lands, and I have been told used to bring back all sorts of curious animals and insects with him. Perhaps this great toad thing I saw was one of the creatures. I've heard toads live for ages. I said I believed that was quite true. I found a queer place one day, said Anklebone. I was going up the turret staircase and found some of the steps moved back. I got Mr. Snaggers and Darkwood, the gardener, and we tugged them out. We called the master, and then we found narrow steps going down to a locked door. We forced it open and got into a stone chamber. There were skulls and bones all over the place. Most of them belonged to animals, but there was a horrible thing on the floor, a sort of mummified vampire bat with huge teeth and enormous outstretched wings, like thick parchment, and four legs. Perhaps it was a regular vampire. They fanned folks to sleep with their great wings and then sucked their blood dry. We cleared out the room and buried all the things in a wood. Now, said Anklebone, I will tell you the end of Sir Guy Ravelstock. He brought back with him from them foreign parts a servant, and they called him the Apostle. Well, one night, continued Anklebone, he and his chums were dining and full of wine, and the A postal offended them somehow, and Sir Guy stabbed him. Then they chained his hands and feet together, took him to the dungeon, and filled his mouth, nose, and ears full of clay and left him. That is the ghost I saw always with Sir Guy, the murdered servant. About 2 years after, Sir Guy and his friends were in the same room drinking, when there came a great hammering at the castle door. Sir Guy drew his sword, flung open the door, and plunged out into the darkness. A few moments passed, and his friends rushed out on hearing wild, unearthly shrieks. But there was no Sir Guy to be seen. He had totally disappeared and was never heard of or seen in life again. We found his remains 3 years ago, but I will tell you of that directly. One day, Snaggers and I had gone to St. Andrew's to buy things. We were just at the end of South Street when a horseman dashed past us at full gallop. "Heaven," said Snaggers, "it's Sir Guy as I live." He went bang into the big iron gates at the cathedral. When we came up, the great gates were locked, and there was Sir Guy leaning up against the west gable, scowling at us. But the white horse had gone, and he melted away as we looked. I saw him again with a servant at Magus Muir, and alone one night at North Street. I was alone one evening in the room below the banquet hall at Lawsdry and heard a pattering on the table. On looking up, I saw a stain in the ceiling, and drops of blood were dropping down on the table and the floor. The room above was the very place where the servant had been stabbed. Next morning, we went into the room where I saw the blood drip, and there was a mark of a bloody hand on the table, but no stain on the roof. Now for the discovery. I'd often dreamed about an old, overgrown well there was in the gardens, and felt very suspicious of what might be therein. Then the gardener and the woodsman told me they had frequently seen the awful specter of Sir Guy and the Apostle hovering round about the thicket that enclosed what was known as the haunted well, and then vanish in the brushwood without disturbing it. I felt sure that there lay the mystery of Sir Guy Ravelstock. The idea was soon after confirmed by a curious occurrence. One morning, Snaggers was dusting an old oil painting over the huge mantelpiece and above the weeping stone in the great hall, when somehow or other he contrived to touch a secret spring, and the painting flew back, opened in its frame, and revealed a chamber beyond. we sent for master, and got down by some steps into the room. Such a queer place. It was octagonal in shape, and there had been either a great fire or an explosion there. The vaulted stone roof and floor were all blackened and cracked, and the fireplace and wood paneling were all burnt and charred. "Perhaps the chapel," I remarked. "That is what master said," replied the butler. "And there were remains of burnt tapestry, charred wood, and documents all over the stone floor. Master got one piece of burnt paper with faded writing on it in some foreign tongue. The odd thing was the big picture. The eyes were sort of convex-like, and two holes were bored in the pupils of each of its eyes, so that anyone standing up on top of the stone stairs could see all that took place in the great hall below, and here also. Master took the piece of parchment and managed to make out a few words. They were, 'I'm sure that Ravelstock lies in the old prior's well, with the dead servant apostle we placed there. I would not go near that spot for my life. Heaven grant it may not come for me. I must leave the place.' That was all he could decipher on the burnt paper. 'We must explore the prior's well. Evidently, that is its name. Tomorrow morning,' said our master. We were all up at dawn and got all the men available to cut down the shrubs, bushes, and the undergrowth around the well, the growth of ages. When the well was exposed, it looked very like the holy well at St. Andrew's, only it had been very finely carved and ornamented at one time. The entrance was a Norman archway, and the remains of an oak door still hung there. We found a shallow bath, shaped pool of muddy water inside, and a lot of broken stones and bits of old statues and glass. At the far end was a large square opening a few feet above the pool of water. We, of course, made for this and found there was a cell beyond. The whole well on one side was riven and rent, either by lightning or the effects of an earthquake shock. If that ancient well could have spoken, it would have told us queer tales as St. Rule's Tower at St. Andrew's. There was a most curious, overpowering, sickening odor inside the place, like a vault or charnel house. I remarked that I knew no smells worse than acetylene gas or the awful smell I unearthed when digging long ago opposite the St. Andrew's Cathedral. "Well," said Anklebone, "I can't imagine a worse odor than there was beside that prior's well. It turned us all so faint. We had to get some brandy. We got into the far cell, and there were two skeleton bodies on the flagged floor. One was a blanched skeleton as far as the neck, but the skull was well preserved, and matted black hair still clung on it and round the jaws. All the teeth were in their place. Some rings had fallen from the bony fingers, and a sword, all eaten away by rust, lay beside the skeleton. The other was like a mummified thing of dark oak color, the nails on the fingers and toes being quite perfect. Chains, also almost worn away, hung around the feet and hands." "Good heavens," said master, "it is Sir Guy Ravelstock and the murdered apostle." There was no doubt of that whatever. We had them removed and buried at once. The mystery was solved after all these long years. The servant apostle had been placed there, but the mystery of Sir Guy was inexplicable. Who came for him that night when he rushed out of the door of Lawsdry Castle, centuries ago, with his sword, and who carried him to his doom in the friar's well? No one can answer that terrible question now. Oh, that the old well could speak and reveal its secret.